It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, our guest says there are alarming trends about the future of elected government in the United States. We'll look at the threats and possible solutions. First, the WPR Reports podcast, Mapped Out, dug into the political redistricting process in Wisconsin when it aired last fall. We looked back at how Republicans redrew district lines to their advantage after winning control of state government in 2010, and the controversy that followed as courts considered whether the state's maps were unconstitutional. We also heard about the first steps in drawing new maps after census data was released last year. A lot has happened since then. Decisions from the state and U.S. Supreme Courts have given Wisconsin one set of maps, then another, with an election just months away. Today, we're getting caught up with a bonus episode of Mapped Out with WPR's Bridget Bowden and Sean Johnson.
Hey, if you're wondering why this popped up in your podcast feed today, let us remind you why we're here.
This is a podcast about redistricting in Wisconsin. It's a process that political parties anticipate every decade. And once it starts, it sometimes feels like it's never going to end.
We started this podcast last September, right before the state legislature introduced its new maps.
And it's been almost 6 months since our last update. 6 months, and a lot of non-redistricting news has happened since then. So maybe we should start with a refresher.
In November, Republicans in the Wisconsin legislature passed their new maps.
A week later, Democratic Governor Tony Evers vetoed them, sending the fight to the state Supreme Court.
The Supreme Court said it would choose a map based on a measure it called least changes. That is, it wanted to make the least changes to the map Republicans drew in 2011.
And that is where we left things. It was kind of tempting to say, game over, Republicans win. All they had to do was submit a least changes map to a conservative Supreme Court. Easy, right?
Other groups submitted their versions of least changes maps. There were maps from Democratic voters, from community groups, from mathematicians. Even the governor submitted a brand new set of maps.
But you know who didn't submit a new map? The legislature. They stuck with the one they passed in the fall, the one that got vetoed.
And it kind of begged the question, why would they do that? Why push ahead with the map that was already rejected by the governor? Why ignore instructions from the state's highest court?
Well, it doesn't matter, because in the end, the strategy would pay off.
From WPR Reports, I'm Sean Johnson.
And I'm Bridget Bowden. This is Mapped Out.
So like we were saying, the Wisconsin Supreme Court considered maps from a lot of different people. In January, they each had a chance to make their case before the justices.
Good morning on this nice, crisp Wisconsin morning. The case we have on for hearing today is Johnson versus Wisconsin Election Commission et al.
The court met for hours that day, and while they covered a lot of ground, the topic of least changes came up repeatedly. Lawyer after lawyer told justices their map was the most least. They included Anthony Russomano, a State Department of Justice lawyer representing Democratic Governor Tony Evers.
Your Honors, it's undisputed in this litigation that the governor's maps make the least changes to the existing, no matter how you slice it.
Now, we should say here, Russomano is not talking about the map Evers endorsed as part of his People's Maps Commission. That map failed in the legislature, and Evers pretty much abandoned it.
And in its place, drew a new map, one that was clearly designed to meet the court's least change mandate. By the numbers, it moved the fewest people from one district to another. In redistricting speak, its core retention score was the best.
Now, remember, the Republican legislature decided not to submit a new map, one that was drawn specifically with least change in mind. Why not?
The legislature's attorney, Taylor Meehan, got a chance to answer that question in an exchange with Justice Rebecca Dallet. Meehan said, there's different ways of defining least change.
The legislature's plan optimizes population equality, it optimizes municipal splits, and it optimizes least changes.
Right. If it doesn't optimize least change, you have to admit you're not the least change.
No, Your Honor, we fundamentally disagree with that. A least changes measure.
So to sum up, the legislature says it's still a lease change map because the population of its districts is closer to equal and it splits fewer municipalities. They say it's okay that they're not the best when it comes to moving people around, to core retention.
But there were signs that the key justice in this case, conservative swing justice Brian Hagedorn, wasn't buying that argument.
So I'm having a hard time understanding why we would now use that standard when that isn't what we told the parties. If we told the parties we wanted you to submit maps that have perfect equality population like the congressional districts, we should have said so, but we didn't say so. We said something quite different, and I don't want to be Charlie Brown and Lucy here.
Charlie Brown and Lucy, you know, the characters from the old Peanuts cartoon.
You just want me to come running up to kick that ball so you can pull it away and see me land flat on my back and kill myself.
This time you can trust me. See, here's a signed document testifying that I promise not to pull it away.
He gets a running start and then...
Lucy pulls it away. Charlie Brown goes flying. The rules were changed at the last minute.
Peculiar thing about this document, it was never notarized.
Other conservative justices have no problems with the legislature's argument. They don't see it as Charlie Brown and Lucy. Hagedorn is the tiebreaker. He's the only justice who's unpredictable. If you can persuade him, you have a good chance of winning your case. And about a month and a half after this hearing, Justice Brian Hagedorn does indeed write the majority opinion in Wisconsin's redistricting case.
He's joined by the court's three liberal justices, and this four-justice majority picks the governor's maps. In this game of lease changes, Evers has won.
The opinion Hagedorn authors is straightforward. He says the governor's map moves the fewest number of people into new districts, and it's, quote, not a close call.
Hagedorn says the other parties to the case don't offer any other measures of lease change that are better than the governor's. He says the governor's assembly map is, quote, vastly superior.
So that's the majority opinion. And at this moment in early March, that opinion is effectively the law of the land in Wisconsin.
The court's other conservative justices disagree. And Justice Patience Rogensack says it's her hope that the United States Supreme Court will be asked to review the case.
And they do. They review it. More on that after the break.
We're listening to the latest episode of the WPR Reports podcast, Mapped Out. We'll hear more from Sean Johnson and Bridget Bowden in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're listening to the newest episode of the WPR Reports podcast, Mapped Out, getting us caught up on the redistricting process in Wisconsin. We just heard about the state Supreme Court decision approving electoral maps drawn by Governor Evers, a decision that was quickly reviewed by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Now, at this point in time, nobody really knows what the U.S. Supreme Court is going to do, because the court doesn't have to do anything. They could just ignore this plea from Wisconsin Republicans like they do with so many other appeals.
But for this case, the U.S. Supreme Court is paying attention. And about 3 weeks after Hagedorn chose the governor's maps, the court steps in and reverses the decision. Evers' victory is short-lived.
Why did the court take such a dramatic step? Because of the Federal Voting Rights Act, the VRA.
Look, we're going to level with you. We find the Voting Rights Act, as it pertains to redistricting, to be complicated. And that's an understatement.
What makes it complicated? Decades of case law, which is not always clearly defined. A lot of math. And what one party says is good for minority voters, another party might say is straight up racist.
When you read Voting Rights Act redistricting decisions, it's easy to get lost in some of the minutiae. You're supposed to start with a three-part test. You consider the totality of the circumstances. VRA cases live and die by this stuff.
And it's not just semantics. There's a reason this law exists in the first place. Marquette University law professor Atiba Ellis is an expert on the VRA.
I think to understand that story, we first have to understand the kind of nature of the racial apartheid that the VRA was designed to fix. And in a way, this takes us all the way back to Reconstruction.
In Ellis's view, a lot of today's political challenges stem from this period in history after the U.S. Civil War. Freed slaves were given rights, but they were incomplete, and new laws were passed that took black people's rights away.
The Voting Rights Act of 1965 was passed as a response to this, an effort to right the country's wrongs.
So the idea is that the Voting Rights Act allows for minority citizens to fully enjoy participation in the political process.
When it comes to redistricting, the VRA can be used to protect those rights in a couple ways. It can be used as a justification for drawing maps a certain way. Mapmakers can draw more majority-minority districts to ensure minority voters get to elect who they want.
The VRA can also be used after maps are drawn to try to overturn them. If minority voters think they've been packed or cracked by a redistricting plan, they can sue. And courts can and do redraw maps based on these claims.
But whether you're being proactive or reactive, the U.S. Supreme Court has said you have to be careful about when you use the VRA. If you give race too much weight, the court has said, you might violate the U.S. Constitution's guarantee of equal protection, the 14th Amendment.
This is where the U.S. Supreme Court says the Wisconsin Supreme Court got it wrong. The governor's map, the one Brian Hagedorn picked, created an additional majority-minority district in Milwaukee.
Hagedorn said he thought there were good reasons to believe that the district was needed, but his opinion didn't say much about why. Ellis says that was the weakness of Hagedorn's ruling.
What the U.S. Supreme Court basically argued was, look, you didn't walk through these factors in sufficient detail for us to determine whether there was a violation.
In a 7-2 unsigned opinion, the U.S. Supreme Court sent the case back to Wisconsin. Ellis says the court essentially ruled that Hagedorn needed to show his work.
Now, at this point in late March, there's still a chance the governor's plan could prevail. So Evers' lawyers get to work. They tell the Wisconsin Supreme Court they could resubmit their map and show their work this time.
Or they could submit a similar map and only adjust the Milwaukee districts.
The legislature disputes this. They tell the court that the governor shouldn't get another chance.
They say the only answer to this problem is a map that is race neutral, one that doesn't consider race at all.
And who has been saying that their map is race neutral since the beginning? The legislature.
In fact, at the public hearing on the legislature's map, only two people testified in favor, Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and Republican Senate Majority Leader Devin Lemahue. And they both stressed a key point about how the maps were drawn.
These employees were instructed not to consider race when drafting the legislative maps.
In hindsight, Voss and Lemahue chose their words very carefully that day. They were laying the groundwork for when this inevitably went to court.
But Marquette Law's Atiba Ellis sees a troubling trend.
The Voting Rights Act, in and of itself, is about being race conscious.
For Ellis, the worst case scenario is that courts put so much emphasis on race neutrality that the Voting Rights Act itself is declared unconstitutional and its protections for minority voters go away.
But in the short term, the race-neutral argument persuades the Wisconsin Supreme Court. On April 15th, the day candidates for the legislature are scheduled to begin circulating nominating petitions to run in the new districts, the court issues a final decision.
Four justices pick the legislature's map. Brian Hagedorn is one of them. Hagedorn does not write the majority opinion in this ruling, but he does write a short 4-page concurrence. He says he didn't think the court's earlier order choosing the governor's maps was based on a Voting Rights Act argument. But once the U.S. Supreme Court said what it said, and with time running out, Hagedorn says the legislature's map was, quote, the remaining option.
University of Wisconsin-Madison law professor and redistricting expert Rob Yablon disputes that.
Even at that late stage, I do think it's an exaggeration to say that there weren't any other options that were available.
Yablon says the Wisconsin Supreme Court could have taken more evidence. They could have reconfigured the Milwaukee districts. They could have drawn a whole new map. These are things courts do, Yablon says.
But instead, the Wisconsin Supreme Court adopted the legislature's map wholesale, without changes. The same map that the governor vetoed and the court itself rejected the first time.
After the opinion came out, Yablon analyzed how the final Wisconsin map compared to other court-drawn maps across the country over the past 20 years. He compared them based on several metrics that measure partisanship. He says the maps endorsed by the Wisconsin Supreme Court are in a league of their own.
These maps really stand out as being maps that look exactly like a very strong partisan gerrymander, the kind that you would expect from a legislature which was trying to tilt the playing field in its favor. And of course, that's what this legislature was trying to do. They were trying to reinforce and perpetuate the gerrymander that they had adopted a decade ago. And ultimately, they got the Wisconsin Supreme Court to sign off on that.
But it's not just a carbon copy of the old map. Lines did move. Districts changed. We're not going to walk you through all of the changes, but we can give you one big picture outcome. There's basically no competition under this map.
And to be sure, there wasn't much competition under the old map either. But in some places, despite the best efforts of mapmakers, competition started to bloom. The population changed, people moved, attitudes changed, and seats that were drawn to be safe became competitive. They were suddenly up for grabs.
This new map shut that down. And it's super apparent in one part of the Milwaukee suburbs.
What we are looking at right here is my district runs down 65th Street right here. And then behind us on Clark.
State Representative Robin Vining's Assembly District includes parts of Milwaukee and Waukesha counties. Historically, Waukesha has been hugely important to Wisconsin Republicans, the base of their power.
Vining's district used to be a part of that. For example, in 2014, Democrats didn't even field a candidate here. It was considered safely GOP.
But over the past decade, Milwaukee's suburbs have been changing. Vining, a Democrat, noticed this.
So back in 2018, we had started to notice a crack in the gerrymander.
Vining saw a growing block of Democratic voters in the district, particularly in her home of Wauwatosa. She thought if she could mobilize those voters, she could win the whole district.
And we looked at the math, and we saw that it was in striking distance. We saw it was possible.
And she was able to do something that no other Democrat had done before her under the 2011 map. Robin Vining flipped a district from red to blue, winning by just 138 votes.
Initially, it seemed like Republican leaders viewed Vining's win as a fluke, not indicative of any pattern. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss told Republicans at the state GOP convention in 2019 that Vining's win would be short-lived.
We lost one seat last time to a woman who's going to be a one-termer. I'm not even going to tell you her name because she's going to lose.
It turns out this win wasn't a fluke. In 2020, Vining won by 8 percentage points. Given what people had assumed about the district, it felt like a landslide.
How did Republicans address Robin Vining's district in the 2021 map? They gave it to her.
Under the new map, the Republican legislature's map, Vining's district becomes a safely Democratic seat. President Joe Biden would have won it by 23 percentage points.
How can conceding a seat to a Democrat be a good thing for Republicans? The districts next to Vining's answer that question.
Like the one held by Democrat Sarah Rodriguez. She ran for the legislature in 2020 against a Republican incumbent.
And it was drawn to be a Republican district at the time. But as the 10 years have gone on, the district had changed. and I was able to...
Like Vining, Rodriguez seemingly beat the odds. She flipped the district, winning by just 735 votes. But unlike Vining, Republicans conceded nothing to Rodriguez in the new map.
Where she used to have parts of Milwaukee County, her new district is almost exclusively Waukesha County. By the numbers, it would be tougher for a Democrat to win here.
And by doing all of that, they also protected a Republican Senate seat that was trending Democratic.
Now that the legislature's map is final, what will elections look like?
Out of 99 assembly districts, only 3 are projected to be within 2 percentage points. Only 3. The rest have basically been decided before a single vote is cast.
Mapped Out is reported by Bridget Bowden
and Sean Johnson. We're produced by Brad Kohlberg, edited by Noah Ovshinsky. Music by Carl Christensen. Additional support from Adam Friedrich.
Digital editing by Alyssa Alamand and digital direction by David Hyland. Photography by Angela Major. Artwork by John Nichols.
You can see more at WPR.org/mappedout.
Coming up after the news, a number of analysts are worried about the future of democracy in the United States, especially after the attempt to overturn the 2020 election outcome. Our guest looks at the emerging threats, what's driving them, and where we can find some signs of hope. Remember, you can follow conversations like these all the time over at WPR.org live stream, or check out the archives, or install the Wisconsin Public Radio app on your smartphone. I'm Rob Verrett. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, we'll talk to a fisheries biologist from the DNR about the start of muskie season here in Wisconsin and how the muskie population is doing around the state. Now, it's election season here in Wisconsin and around the country, with midterm primaries underway and the general election in November. Issues like the economy, education, and crime are big topics, as usual. But another big issue may be the future of democracy itself. Our next guest writes, there are growing threats to our system of elected government in the United States. She says power has become more consolidated, making minority rule possible, decreasing political competition. And she says political theater has become more dominant than substantive debate, which means real issues that affect voters aren't always talked about. I want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have some basic concerns about our system of government, our system of representative government in the United States? How about specific things like gerrymandering, the role of the Supreme Court, the U.S. Senate, the filibuster? Do those in particular worry you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Julia Azari is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. Julia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we get into some of the specific concerns you raised in a recent piece, I just want to kind of get your temperature on this. You know, it's a normal election season in some ways. Candidates are talking about issues like they normally do. But there are people worried that there are fundamental threats to the future of this whole system of elections and democracy. How worried are you?
So I'm sort of in the middle, I think, in terms of where political scientists and other people who watch this stuff closely are. I think there are people who are really, really concerned. And one of the pieces that I reference, one of the ideas that I reference in the piece, is someone who's written kind of about the conditions of civil war and said that the United States looks like a place that's going to go into civil war. And I think everyone who follows politics can can really relate to the idea that sometimes you see the temperature being turned just way up and it feels like no compromise can be had. On the other hand, though, I think, as I write in the piece, I think there are some reasons for hope, and that we're at this sort of moment right now that we could see as really a big crisis, or we could also see as a kind of important inflection point where we really, as a country, started paying attention to a lot of important issues and thinking about how we do this, how we work together as a country across lots of difference to really have self-government, to have government by the people in a way that includes everybody. So I think there's reason for hope. There's reason to think this country's quite resilient, but there's also a lot of things in our politics that are not consistent with what many of us, I think, grew up to expect from a democratic country and from our system.
Yeah, that's one of the core themes in your recent piece, that some of our institutions of government don't very well reflect popular opinion, popular sentiment in the United States. What kind of things do you have in mind?
A lot of things when I started to think about it, which is not great. If you're like me and you grew up in this country in the 1980s, in my case, and kind of learned that the core of democracy is we have checks and balances, but we do have a kind of sense that the people rule. And it's not that majority always rules, but that it sort of moves in that general direction. And that when governing institutions, when governing bodies do things that people don't like, that the people have some recourse. That's the sort of story of the American Revolution that I learned growing up. And what we see instead is, a Senate that reflects a design that was done at a time when the state population differences were much smaller than they are now. So it's very unequal in terms of how many people each senator represents. We see, here in the state of Wisconsin, our state legislature set up in a way that it's just impossible for one of the two parties to win in a state that's very competitive and where in many offices, it's normal to expect Democrats and Republicans to flip back and forth and share power, because that reflects the balance of opinion in our state. You see this with the power that the courts have, and the Supreme Court in particular. If no institution's really checking the court, they can basically do whatever they want. And I've been thinking about this for about a decade, about that kind of the ability of the court to rule on issues like campaign finance. Of course, everyone's thinking about abortion. It's possible we're going to get a ruling soon on gun control. To rule in ways that are really out of step with how most Americans think. And that's not how I learned that was supposed to be.
Let's focus in on the Supreme Court for a little bit. A very solid conservative majority. There's an argument with the Supreme Court that, hey, it's not supposed to move with public sentiment and popular opinion. They're supposed to be preserving fundamental, foundational ideas of American government. How worried are you that they've swayed too far from public sentiment?
Yeah, I'm a bit worried about it. And I think no one really has the final authority on what the Supreme Court is supposed to do. The Article 3 in the Constitution that sets up the judicial branch is pretty sparse. Our notion of judicial review comes instead from kind of informal understandings that developed early on in the Republic. People point to different cases to establish that the court is supposed to kind of protect fundamental rights from this majority that wants to take them away. And I think we have to think really critically about what that actually means in practice, what it actually means to protect rights. And if by definition, if the court makes a decision, that doesn't mean that rights are being protected, right? That's, I think, the key response I would have to that is no one really has a monopoly on what it is the court is supposed to do. And if they were to play that role, if they were to play this sort of what we call in political science counter-majoritarian, kind of rolls off the tongue, if they were to play that role where they're protecting rights against a majority that wants to take them away, then that could be an important role. But it's also, it doesn't mean that they get to have a kind of unchecked ability to do that. It would mean that the other two branches are checking their power. And we don't really see that happening in a meaningful way in contemporary politics. So that's that's the other thing I think that sort of happened as the role of the Supreme Court has kind of evolved over time in politics.
How about dysfunction in another branch of government? People often point to Congress with inability or unwillingness to pass a lot of laws that I think people are hoping to see something happen on. Years of debate over immigration, for example. The government often works by a presidential executive order and court challenges to that order back and forth. Is there something in Congress that would help it step up and be a more equal branch of government, if I'm even right to say that it's dysfunctional in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty slow. And again, we kind of get to this question of, like, how are these things supposed to operate? What was the original logic of the design? How does that logic compare with what's going on in our country now? And people, again, have been kind of talking about Congress. You know, there's this book called The Broken Branch that I think was first published in 2006. So we've been talking a lot about Congress in this regard. Immigration is a big focus there. There was a lot of talk amongst some students I was teaching last week about why gun control failed in 2013 after Sandy Hook, particularly some pretty middle-of-the-road compromise measures that are quite popular with Americans. I mean, I think that one big thing there, you hear a lot about the filibuster, making the Senate by default a 60-vote body. Let me say this carefully. I think that if there were a possibility that 60-vote requirement meant that you did have to build big, broad compromises, get a lot of people on board, get a lot of different perspectives, come to a common ground between conservatives and liberals, if that 60-vote threshold were achieving that goal, then that could be a good thing. But instead, it just means nothing ever gets passed because people in the Senate and on many pieces of legislation, important, you know, high stakes legislation, are going to vote party lines. And it's pretty unusual for one party to get 60 votes. So that's sort of my take on the filibuster.
Talking to Julia Azari from Marquette University about dysfunction in American government, threats to our system of representative government. You can join in at 800-642-1234. You also write that political spectacle has taken over more and more as opposed to substantive debate. What kind of things are you looking at?
Yeah, so I'm looking, I mean, let's be honest, I'm spending way too much of my time looking at Twitter. but, you know, I'm not alone. And I think that between social media, between cable, there's so many opportunities to sort of score political points, right? To make a video or do a tweet or both, or there's probably some other social media I'm not even thinking about. I don't know what goes on TikTok. I'm too old. But, you know, there's a lot of, I think, opportunities to kind of score political points or create some kind of spectacle, as opposed to tackling something that really actually matters and that people actually care about. And that's kind of the thing that I was thinking about as I was thinking about some of these issues, is that you'll see representatives, elected officials, or people seeking office kind of using their platform to score political points and talk about what the other side isn't doing, or to talk about these sort of explosive cultural issues, that some of which are not really, you know, issues that are on the public mind, rather than addressing the economy, which is almost always everyone's top priority, security, you know, war in Ukraine, there's any number of issues people are concerned about. Climate change, certainly something I hear a lot about in my work with young people. So that is essentially what I meant by that.
Julia Azari is with us, associate professor of political science at Marquette University. She's talking to us about the state of American democracy, possible threats to our system of representative government, possible solutions to those problems. You can join in at 800-642-1234. In this election year, do you feel like it's a normal election year? You're looking at the normal sorts of things you would watch for from a candidate, or do you have a bigger sense that something is at risk, that something is threatened here in the way we do representative democracy in the United States? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Julia Azari. She's an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. We're looking at the ways that American representative government may not be functioning well, maybe some possible fixes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Richard is with us in Waukesha. Richard, hi.
Yeah, I'm concerned about the response to January 6th and how it seems sympathizers to the argument that Trump won the election have been getting elected and or appointed to positions which are going to control the election in 2024.
Richard, thanks for the call. Julia?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think people are very concerned about that. And I think that, you know, one of the reasons that the 2020 election during some very tough conditions went down in terms of the counting of the votes as smoothly as it did is because there were Republicans and Democrats alike at the state and local level who are election officials who did their jobs. Those positions tend to be very low attention kind of offices, and people who are sympathetic to kind of violent perspectives are I think in some cases are winning these primaries. The primaries are still going on. I think that's a big concern. I talk a little bit about that in the sort of the consolidation of power part of the article about the ways in which some of what's going on in our country has tipped from like, okay, the two parties are always trying to jockey a little bit for an advantage to, okay, there's a specific movement. And I think it's largely contained in one party, which is even more unfortunate. It's concentrated that has, you know, decided to reject elections. And that's everybody of every political persuasion should be really concerned about that. And we should, I think, all be invested in the integrity of our democracy. And then we can battle it out about the issues, of course, peacefully.
Richard, thanks for that call. Matt joins us now in Minocqua. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Ms. Azari. Just a quick shout out to you. My son graduated from Marquette about 4 years ago, and he sang your praises, said you're an amazing teacher and had a great experience in your class. So, that was for you. But yeah,
thank you.
My question is, you know, to me, it seems like a no-brainer that term limits would be a solution to a lot of our problems. I know that, you know, there's people for and against. I'm just wondering what your opinion is for or against term limits, if that would, you know, solve a lot of the problems and the dysfunction in our government.
Matt, thanks for the call. We've got term limits for our presidents, Julia, but of course not for Congress. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. So term limits are probably the area where professional political scientists are the furthest away from mainstream public opinion. Political scientists tend to, I won't say we all hate term limits. So there's a range of opinion, but most people are skeptical. And the main reason for this, and there's some research on this, which I don't have in front of me, but the basic idea is when you have newcomers coming into Congress constantly, one of the things that they become more dependent on is kind of interest groups and lobbyists for more information. And so when you don't have experienced legislators, you become even more, the system becomes even more dominated by these organized and well-funded interests. That's one concern. Another concern, you kind of think about, like, well, what are the incentives of people in their last term? You know, what are they thinking about? If they're not interested in courting re-election, then what are they trying to do? And often people, I think, are suspicious that the answer is trying to get a job, again, at one of these well-paying lobbying firms. And, you know, I think there's a great book about term limits for presidents by a scholar named Michael Corzi, C-O-R-Z-I. I don't remember the name of the book, but it's something pretty straightforward that kind of mostly talks about how they came to be. But a little bit, I think it's worth thinking about, like, has this been a good development for the presidency? Has it limited presidential power, which I think is somewhat of a seemingly contradictory answer, but it seems like no. On the plus side, I will say of term limits, I do think there are some people in the scholarly profession who are kind of sympathetic to the problems with term limits. But on the other hand, it's like, okay, it's become absurd for people to serve in Congress for decades upon decades. That is, you know, really, I think, does violate a lot of people's sense of what democracy should be about and does give a sense that folks are really insulated from, you know, from any real political pressure to do what their constituents want. They're just kind of there. They don't ever really face any true accountability. We can debate about that. Some people might say, well, if you like your representative, you should be able to keep voting for them if they're doing a good job. So I think it's really, I think there's really a live debate to be had about that. But I do think that there's widespread concern about members of Congress serving for these just, you know, enormous amounts of time.
Matt, thanks for calling in, talking to Julia Azari from Marquette University about potential threats to American representative government. One more point I wanted to get to in that piece we referenced. You're worried about the normalization of white supremacy in politics. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I mean, I've spent a lot of time talking about that over the last couple of years. And I think that this, you know, one issue that I've sort of seen subtly creep up is more and more kind of extremist views becoming expressed in more mainstream ways. We have seen some of that. We have kind of seen, you know, what happened a couple months ago when this is more fresh in my mind when I wrote the piece a while back. But some members of Congress, Republicans, had gone to a white supremacy conference. They were rebuked by Republican Party leadership, GOP leadership, distance themselves from that. But the way our parties are structured, they don't have a lot of control over it. So I'm very concerned about that. I'm also concerned about the ways in which there's kind of everyday racism that seeps into politics and in both parties. I wrote a little bit about this and about some research that suggests, you know, Democrats also will kind of distance themselves from the concerns of African-American and other non-white citizens when they feel like it's politically advantageous, and that's often the case. So I think this is something where I don't think this is playing out the same way in the two parties. I know that's not what some people want to hear, but that's what I think. But yet at the same time, I think that there is, the party system doesn't do a great job championing the concerns of communities of color, and our history means that those concerns do need to be addressed through the political system. That's, I guess, how I would phrase that.
Julia, just a couple minutes left, and I think I've biased our conversation more on the threat side and less on the hope side. Talk a little more about the hopes you have to overcome some of these problems.
Yeah, so I have a couple of hopes in terms of thinking about where we're at and where we've been. One is that I think part of it is there are a lot of people invested in the stability of this country. We have a really robust, what I describe in the piece, of civil society, of organizations, of private businesses and industry. A lot of organized ways in which people operate in our society. And it's fairly rare, I think, to see an authoritarian takeover when you have such a robust civil society and so many people who are invested in our country continuing to operate. I also think these are often, like I said, when you look back in history, these moments of great tension and conflict are really the moments where you see, like, this is where things change. This is where things get better for groups that have historically been left out of the conversation or been kept out of opportunities because of who they are. This is how change occurs. And it also seems like we actually do have some agreement on some of the major issues, maybe not on everything, but a country that has kind of like modest majorities in favor of a number of issue stances and kind of progress that they would like to see. It's just a matter of our government being able to reflect that. So I think, like, in contrast with other points in time when the country was really truly deeply divided, I think there are actually areas where we're less divided than it might appear.
Julia, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Thanks to the callers for great questions.
That's Julia Azari, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. She talked to us about why American democracy may have become fractured and, as we just heard, some signs of hope for our system. Maybe that things will get better as we get through it all. Always time for you to share your thoughts on these conversations. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or email us a note, ideas@WPR.org. Remember, follow Great Conversations each and every day here on the radio, of course. Stream us online at WPR.org. You can check out the Ideas Network stream there or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app to your smartphone or comparable device. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, doctors are changing the way they talk about weight and obesity with their patients. Find out why and join in with your own thoughts on the topic, maybe your own experiences as a healthcare provider or patient yourself. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Yesterday on the show, we invited your calls about the games you play, board, card, and more. We heard from a lot of you on the air. More of you joined in on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ravana writes, I love Rummy, Dominoes, and Whist, but cribbage is my go-to. I always travel with a pocket cribbage board and a deck of cards. You meet a bunch of interesting people if you stand up on a train and call out, who here wants to play cribbage? Melissa writes, I just love games and I have so many fun game-related stories. One of my favorites was when I was in college visiting my boyfriend on spring break. I won a game of Magic the Gathering against his super arrogant and annoying friend, quote-unquote, who completely underestimated me. Melissa says, I had to tap everything. I had but one life point, but it was one life point more than the guy I took out. And Zachary says, I started branching out in solitaire games and picked up Canfield. Hard to win, but addictive. It has a fun history, too. Keep sharing your games on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time.